Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This week, we chose to air an interview that I did with a man who got punched unconscious in downtown Seattle while wearing a swastika armband. He said he's not a Nazi. Many of you have told me if you wear a swastika, you're a Nazi. We'll discuss that in a moment. I have some big regrets about that interview. I added to the pain and the fear in this country, this city. People I know and respect, people I love, have told me they feel hurt, disgusted, betrayed, scared, and angry. And that hurts. I'm sorry for causing that pain. But it's more than that. It's not just, I'm sorry if you were offended. I made some careless, callous decisions. And that hurts too. And it's not acceptable. I want to tell you why I did it, how we failed, and what you can expect from KUOW. So first of all, why I did it. Here's the first sentence of our mission statement. The mission of KUOW is to create and serve an informed public, one challenged and invigorated by an understanding and appreciation of events, ideas, and culture. And I failed at that, and I'll tell you why. I apologize. My intent was that you would get a better appreciation of what you were already hearing about this man if you heard from him directly. KUOW believes in allowing everyone to speak, even people with offensive views, because democracy works best when we speak freely and listen. That's the idea. NPR's position on this is simple. Quote, we cover the world as it is, not as we wish it were. I still believe that. And we're still committed to challenging you, presenting ideas you might not agree with. But the interview failed in that mission to create an informed public. The man did not even express Nazi ideology, but he may well be a liar who pretends to be moderate so he can recruit moderate conservatives to the Nazi cause. In fact, I interviewed a history professor yesterday who thinks that's exactly what he wanted and that I helped him. This interview also prompted a debate within this show and across the station about when we should grant anonymity. KUOW's ethics guidelines are to grant it only if we verify the person is who they say they are and we have a compelling reason for anonymity. Well, we verified he was the man who got punched, and when he told us he worried for his safety, we took that as a compelling reason to hide his name. But of course, that didn't compel us to air it. Not airing it at all would have been better than the way that we did it. It aired by itself without immediate balance or context. And the final part of the mission statement I read you is that we will help you be challenged and invigorated by an understanding of ideas. And here's where I feel the worst. I am human. I have my biases and my blind spots and my comfort zones. I have this blanket idea that more speech is good. I don't believe everything my guests say. I have this idea that everyone can be as skeptical as I am. And over time, truth will outshine because you feel it when you hear it. That's why I do this job. I try so hard to understand and connect with the person sitting across from me because I want us all to learn and to feel each other's humanity. And again, that did not happen with this interview. And finally, I want to talk about what I believe, which I really don't like to do on the air. I've had one radio job where I was supposed to be an opinionator, and I was bad at it. My heart was not in it. There are so many people we could be listening to besides me. I have always held to the idea of journalistic neutrality. I've held on to that, even as people have been oppressed and victimized all around me. I know it. I've seen it my whole life. And this year is different. You can feel that. So I want to tell you that I cherish the humanity inside every one of us. Our humanity is precious, and it's vulnerable. It feels vulnerable. And even journalists have a responsibility to guard it. And I knew that, and I let my duty slip this week. So I'm sorry for that. You should expect better from KUOW. And I promise to do better. Okay? Thanks for listening. Now let's do some more talking, because that's what we do on the Week in Review. My guests this week are Joni Balter, former Seattle Times opinion writer, host of Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail. Hi, Joni.
Hey there.
Rob McKenna, former Washington State Attorney General. Hi, Rob.
Go Dogs.
Dave Ross, host of Seattle's Morning News on Cairo Radio. Welcome, Dave.
Hi, Bill.
So we're going to talk about what happened on 3rd and Pine on Saturday and what journalism's role should be. I'm going to start with our only Jewish panelist today, Joni. Well, I just laid out a whole bunch of stuff. What's the first thing you want to say?
Well, first of all, I'd like to congratulate you for this amount of self-reflection on something like that. That's my first thought. My second thought is timing was really awful. Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, so that makes people a little more sensitive to just this entire topic.
Do you think the fact that Wednesday was the first day of Rosh Hashanah should have affected our decisions?
I don't know about that. I think that makes it high, you know, makes your call here more sensitive to the audience because they're experiencing that, right? Mm-hmm. So I've been an editor as well, and I've made calls that I loved and some that I didn't love so much. I will say to the folks who are, you know, maybe against what you did originally, that these calls are art, not science, that we make close calls all the time. You made a close call. And, you know, I would hope that in that situation that I wouldn't have given a microphone to, you know, what goes on at 3rd and Pine or 2nd and Pine for that matter to have. I mean, if you run a mic down there on any given day, you're going to get some wild stuff, right? So I don't like the idea of elevating this, and that's kind of what happened. On the other hand, I understand the way this came down is that this person called in to you. It's not mm-hmm. that you went out and solicited this.
Why does that matter to the listener?
Well, I'll tell you why it matters, because we allow in comments from Facebook and Twitter, and we try to make it here, and I've been on the show quite, you know, a long time. We try to make it a conversation. And so the fact that someone called you, again, I don't like elevating this individual who's not giving their name, who's out to be a provocateur, who's raising some pretty hate-filled stuff here, possibly. But he called
or me. Refusing to raise it as he did with me.
Right. I listened to that. But he did call in, and you give a lot of heft to people who are listening and want to be part of the conversation. So I think that made it a more difficult call in your case, that you wanted to hear from them. Well, you're the guy. You're the guy who was in the news because someone punched you. So what the heck is going on with you? That's where you were coming from, I imagine. And so that's sort of another factor here.
Yeah, and I don't regret that. It's more that did we find out what the heck was going on with them or anything else useful? And I'd like to open it up. A longtime journalist, Dave Ross.
I did talk to him. I want to hear what he's going to do if his side is elected. That's what our function is. I mean, if we're going to talk about what put the Nazis in power, it was an election. They proposed a pretty clear agenda, and people voted for it. In this guy's case, the shortcoming I saw with your interview, and I heard the edited version. I guess you had a longer version.
Much longer.
I haven't heard that. What I didn't hear in the edited version.
And no one has. We aired it. We put it on tape and just boiled it down.
I didn't hear what he would do if he were to be put into power. This is what these guys don't want to talk about, I find, generally. I did listen to a very long interview with one of the organizers of the Charlottesville demonstration. A journalist was embedded with this guy, and they talked at length about what his agenda was. And it came across as, frankly, crazy. And the longer they talked, the more he came across as a kind of crazy. And that's the kind of journalism that I like. I want to hear people explain themselves, and it becomes very clear, without even having to ask a lot of leading questions, whether you would ever want to grant power to someone like this or not. And in a democracy, that's what the electorate needs to know. Now, if people are complaining, well, we don't want to put these ideas out there because they are harmful, then you're asking for censorship. And not only do I not believe in that, it's not possible anymore. It used to be that the mainstream media could determine what people heard. And we made decisions all the time based on matters of taste, on ideas that we personally thought were just too dangerous to put on the air. That doesn't work anymore. You can't do that. So I would rather have thoughtful people like you conduct this interview than, you know, some partisan who's got an agenda.
Well, thank you. I've conducted a lot of thoughtful interviews. I still don't think this was one, but you know, that happened. That's happened before. But I just want to pick up on one idea that Dave raised, which is the idea that if you let someone talk, they'll come off as crazy. Because that is that's one of the things at the heart of this. This history professor and many listeners and friends have told me, No, if you let this guy, he didn't spew Nazi ideology, but you let him pretend, oh, it's just a symbol, and he came off seeming moderate. And the fear from this history professor and others is that allows more moderate conservatives to say, well, yeah, I kind of agree with that guy. What else does he have to say? And
well,
now you're down the road.
He came off just talking about the symbol, which doesn't interest me. It's not the symbol of the swastika, which he has a right to wear if he wants to. This is America. It's not Germany.
Exactly.
What needs to be asked is, what do you think that stands for? And what would you do if you were elected to a legislature, or if you were elected to some position of power? Are you going to create colonies for people based on race? You're going to make people wear tags based on their religion? And then we quickly find out whether he really takes these ideas seriously, or whether he's a troll, or whether this was just staged for the media's benefit. I mean, that stuff comes out.
So you're advocating possibly airing more hate speech if that's what he was offering?
Well, possibly.
Right?
I mean, okay. For example, when the anarchists descended on WTO and we got a hold of one, I started talking to him. I said, you're anarchists, you don't believe in leadership. Who runs your meetings? And what exactly would you do if you had any power? So we wouldn't do anything. So how would you fill the potholes? That's not any of our concern. I mean, pretty soon it breaks down into absurdity when you have these guys who are just there, who are just trolls. I met a guy like that in Cleveland at the Republican convention. He was an anti-capitalist. I said, so how would you run an economy? He didn't know. He just spewed stuff, and the interview became boring. We didn't air it. But I mean, that's what I think our job is as journalists.
I just wanted to add, Bill, in the interview that you conducted that I heard you trying to get meaningful material out of this person, and I think I'm recalling like one of the last things he said in there, and that was, what was your big goal? It was like to walk around for 45 minutes and sort of see if I could come back and not get punched and see how things would go for me. Like, wow, that's deep, as in completely not.
Rob McKenna.
So I think it's really interesting, first of all, to listen to three journalists wrestle with these issues. I think it's very interesting and important discussion to have. I do have some questions, having listened to the edited version of the interview. And the first question is, did he represent himself as being a believer in or a member of the Nazi Party?
No.
Did he distance himself from the Nazis ideologically? In other words, did he say, I just wore it to be provocative, I actually think the Nazis are terrible people?
No, he didn't say that.
So it seemed to come down to what I heard in the edited interview, that he was deliberately trying to be provocative and trying to point out some sort of perceived hypocrisy, that he couldn't walk down the street for 5 minutes with a swastika without being punched out, but if he'd walked down the street wearing a hammer and sickle, he would have gotten high-fived.
Yeah, he said in the interview that liberals have become like fascists in the sense of being intolerant of other views. That's it.
That's what I heard too. So I mean, so a lot of your listeners and the people who commented on this assumed he was a Nazi. Maybe he is. I guess we don't know. But he didn't use your platform to espouse Nazi ideology or to advance some sort of platform the way that the Charlottesville guy did with that long interview you listened to, Dave. So I just think that's worth knowing. This guy did a deliberately provocative thing to make a point about his view of hypocrisy.
As I noted, though, the concern. Oh, I want to hear what you have to say about the concern that you let a Nazi, or that's an its own separate discussion, if you wear a swastika, are you a Nazi, but that you let him dissemble and have a platform. He got exactly what he wanted as a recruitment tool to people who may not be Nazi sympathizers yet, but they could be.
Yeah, I mean, possibly. I mean, I didn't hear that. What I heard him talking about was this idea of, you know, the swastika versus the hammer and sickle. And he was, you know, he's apparently a Trump supporter, was very upset with Antifa and so forth. So, I did hear him talk about the First Amendment. And that's of course, completely misleading in this context, because he wasn't arrested for wearing the swastika. The First Amendment, along with the rest of the Bill of Rights, protects all of us and our rights from state action. It does not guarantee that we won't get punched out for offending someone who we're walking down the street. And we have an entire system set up.
Or lose
for
your
that.
Job.
Right. Well, we call this, you know, for example, the criminal justice system. You can get punched out, and then that person who chooses to use violence against you can be charged. And it may be that there's not much of a sentence involved or even a conviction if the jury is sympathetic to him. That's completely outside of this idea of free speech. No one was infringing on his free speech from a government standpoint, and yet he tried to make it sound like it was a government action.
Okay,
I just wanted to add here, wasn't it a couple of weeks or months ago where Alex Jones, right-wing provocateur as well, who was walking down the streets of Seattle, and somebody, and this is very Seattle, threw hot coffee on him.
Yeah.
You know, so we have folks out there who object to this in their way. It's not the state, as Rob said, but it's a Seattle people saying, I object to something.
Here's another objection.
You're taking your chances is my point. And I don't have any sympathy for the guy for getting punched out. And the guy decided to punch him. If he'd been arrested, he could be charged with assault. And he's taking his chances.
But he has been arrested. And you were talking about, you were concerned about recruiting, Bill. I think the recruiter was whoever punched him. The guy now becomes a martyr on social media. And people can point to Seattle and say, this is where liberalism gets you. They resort to physical violence. And my concern is that because that's gone unaddressed, what will happen the next time somebody wants – actually, you attract more people to do this kind of thing.
Do you mean he should have – the person who punched him, if he were identified, should have been arrested?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, he still could –
it's assault. Now, as you point out –
he could file charges. He hasn't filed charges.
Right,
he could.
But here's my point. What this does is give them an excuse to say, okay, since if you walk around alone with a swastika, you get punched out. So we'll walk in twos.
Yeah.
Or we'll walk in threes. And then it begins to escalate. And that's my concern.
And does media have a role in stopping that from happening?
Well,
not giving the platform like we did
to
the person who wore one swastika alone?
I think the cops have to be impartial when it comes to justice. If there's an assault committed and he doesn't want to press charges, at least make it clear that this guy apparently didn't believe it was an assault. And so it's not as if...
We don't know that he didn't believe it.
Well, the guy who punched him or the guy who...
No, I'm saying the guy who decided not to press charges.
Yeah.
He didn't think it was important enough.
He actually still has time on that, but you know that didn't seem to be the point of
what we need to do is make
about.
It clear that the reason charges are not being pressed is because of him. He doesn't want to witness them.
Right.
So this is not...
He doesn't want his name out there.
City of Seattle saying it's open season.
He doesn't want his name out there.
Here's another objection. A KOW listener wrote, I'm fine with you interviewing a Nazi, but your horrendous decision to give Nazis the succor and comfort of anonymity changed you from a legitimate news outlet into a fascist propaganda tool. I'm sure y'all had the best of intentions. Good job on paving the road to hell in the meantime. Should we have let him be anonymous?
Probably not. I think that was maybe one of the worst parts of it.
So that means don't air it at all because he wouldn't have come on the air without anonymity.
Again, back to art and not science. You know, there are a lot of factors here. The fact that we still don't know what his name is, and that's clearly one of the reasons he's not going to file charges, that does give him the platform that only costs him the punch. It doesn't cost him anything else about his name or his job or his anything, his landlord, he mentioned.
Yeah, so we should have said no anonymity.
The thing is, there are crazy people who are going to track him down and do something worse than punch him. I think that's the problem there. And journalists are putting on anonymous information all the time to protect people for, I think, far less than physical harm. They sometimes do it to protect them from being fired or protect them from embarrassment. You have to decide if you think the information is important enough to the listener to put it on the air. And you know, the risk that we run is that people won't listen to us. But I'd rather that be the case than us starting to pre-censor everything because we're worried about hurting people's feelings. I mean, we're all grown-ups here. If it hurts you, then don't listen to it. We're not deliberately trying to hurt people or give them trauma. We're trying to present information on topics that are current and important.
And here's an argument that it's about more than that, Dave. A listener who I know personally, we had an exchange about this, and I asked, so are you saying NPR and KUOW should change our policy, should have a no Nazi on the air policy? Because we don't have that policy. And we had a back and forth, and she says, but I draw the line. She says she's a proponent of the freedom of speech, et cetera. But I draw the line with Nazis because these are not just people with bad ideas. This isn't a new oddity. We should examine respectfully. This is dangerous. History has shown us how dangerous this is. It's a horrible thing that humans should engage in anything that is so dangerous that it does not belong on public radio. But this is it. This is what we have right now, and it's terrifying. That's her.
I mean, throughout human history, we've tried to suppress ideas, and it never works. What you do is make sure that in a democracy, nobody falls for the idea and puts that idea into power. That's the best we can do.
Can we make sure of that?
I think people, it's up to us. I mean, you get what you vote for. except when the Electoral College takes over. But, you know, as long as you vote for in the right eight states. But you get what you – and it's a, that's why not everybody wants a democracy. There are plenty of people in the countries in the world that look at this and say, this is the very thing we're trying to avoid by making sure that our leaders are hereditary or that they're approved by some religious leader, because that prevents us from getting in. It used to be our nomination process was there to prevent the voters from doing irrational things. But we have elected to have a, with the internet, a purer and purer democracy. And so that means that whoever wins the popular mind for whatever reason gets power. Well, I think then it's our obligation to make sure at least the popular mind knows what it's voting for.
So, Bill, you said that you asked the question, should there be a no Nazis policy on NPR? Never interview, never give them a platform at all. And that raises, of course, the classic problem of line drawing, right? So you're making the decision that this ideology is so offensive, we want to keep them off. I wouldn't mind not hearing Nazis. I find them incredibly offensive and disturbing. There are other groups that wouldn't mind hearing either. So do I get to provide a list of people that offend other people, additional people who also offend me that I also think should not be given a platform, like communists, Stalinists?
But what she's saying very clearly, and many people have said, is this is different. Don't pretend it's not. We're not in a unique moment in history, a history that we've seen before, how it's played out. It's not academic.
So that's the careful balance here. Of course, you shouldn't have a list of viewpoints that you won't air, as much as I don't want to hear them. I don't think anyone here wants to hear more from Nazis or folks who think anything about Nazis is funny. That we don't need to hear that. But you can't have a policy like that, because it'll always come down to that context. What are we talking about? Is the person identified? Is someone challenging them in that same interview or shortly thereafter? I mean, I thought you were challenging him too in that interview. But
I was, but we could have done a lot better shortly thereafter.
We could have had the puncher in there. How about the puncher?
We could. We've done many interviews around this, but we could have. Because we didn't have to run the interview immediately. It was taped. It was edited. We could have grouped it with more thought, more of the stuff I read you, our mission statement, right? More enlightenment, more invigorating.
Well, you put the professor on the next day, right?
Yes, yes.
And even she couldn't figure out where the line should be drawn.
Yeah, that's right.
So, I mean, it's a difficult thing.
Okay, another note to make, and maybe we'll have more to say before we move on, is that there were witness reports that this man was harassing people on the street, throwing bananas at people of color. I did ask him about that stuff, and he denied it to us. So, again, whether you believe him or not, that's some people have wondered. What about the allegations that it wasn't just he was wearing an armband? Well, there was more going on. I wasn't there in the video. It's not in the video. It's a very, very short video. As it begins, it's about three words of him just speaking and not yelling. And so I asked, and I know what most of our listeners feel about his denials. But that's one. And I just also want to mention for people listening, you know, there are people here. We also aired this interview the day before with the anti-fascist, and I played some of it to this man
right.
who wore the swastika, and he talked about how it's not academic for him, that he feels a physical target of violence, and him and his family, you know, and loved ones, violence done by people who wear swastikas. And so here we are talking about more than just journalistic ethics, and we're four white people, one Jewish person sitting around the table. I want to note that. As well.
Duly noted.
Okay. What else?
Well, I come down on the side of, you know, interviewing him and not airing actual audio of him, because he wanted, you know, you could have reported the news,
yeah.
You could have reported that you interviewed him, here's what he said, and not actually aired it, because he refused to give his name. He was dodging some of the obvious questions about his own ideology. There was information he was engaged in other behavior down there that could have been independently verified. I think it could have been done differently as well. Under other circumstances, you know, maybe you end up with an interview like the interview of the guy in Charlottesville that Dave described, but these were not those circumstances.
And I'm curious now.
Yeah.
I'm a little worried. Is this going to paralyze you in terms of who you determine to interview in the future, because you're going to agonize over what each of, you know, 50,000 listeners might think?
Good question. I don't think it's going to paralyze me. What we just came to was we can tweet it out right now if we could. Al Letson, the host of the public radio show Reveal, did a long interview with Richard Spencer. Mm-hmm. And I found it that it met our mission statement, okay? Other people might disagree with that. I'm not ready to change our policy on that, and I could do better. And if I can do better, I would like to share it with our mm-hmm. listeners. So we can tweet out that interview if you'd like to hear it. In this case, I could have just, in an interview that I don't think met those criteria, crossed that bar, I could just say, by the way, here's what the guy, we confirmed his identity and he called us and here's what he said. I can report the relevant parts. But I don't feel paralyzed yet, but it's more pausing than being paralyzed because I'm trying to listen and know what I didn't know and take it in.
Well, I have a question about it. What made you feel that you had to rush it out so quickly?
Just journalistic
habit.
You know, it's just like
a reporter.
I'm a reporter. Yeah, and I'm not saying it's actually the part when I said at the end, like I kind of feel the worst about it because I think in the habit of mind of a reporter. We just spoke about this guy yesterday. Let's have him on today.
Yeah.
Now, not later. And we just discussed the reason why it didn't have to be that way. I don't think much would have been lost, but I don't want to lose, Dave, that reporter edge that says, get it on, get it while it's relevant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Fair enough.
For now. Dave Ross, Cairo radio host, and Rob McKenna, former state attorney general, Joni Balter, host of Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail, and you talking about the stuff that mattered this week. Thanks for the conversation. You know it's not over. I'm still listening. I'm humble and listening and still committed. So thank you. More to come. So come right back. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We have a Republican challenger for Congress in the 8th District. That's East King and Pierce counties and stretching over the Cascades to Wenatchee and Ellensburg. Republican Congressmember Dave Reichert is retiring. Democrats see this as a House seat they might be able to pick up. Yesterday, a well-known Republican, State Senator Dino Rossi, got into the race. And you know who also ran in the 8th District? Dave Ross, you ran as a Democrat, 14 years ago?
I did, yes.
And lost to Dave Reichert. What does Dino Rossi's entry do to Democrats' hopes here?
Well, I mean, Dino Rossi is a moderate. He is well-spoken. He has a pretty good reputation in this state. I got to know him a little bit on the campaign trail because he was running for governor at the same time as I was running for Congress. And I think he's formidable. I looked over the names of Democrats. I don't know any of them. So I think they have a pretty high hill to climb. But, of course, in their favor, and of course it depends on what happens over the next year or so, is that Dino Rossi will inevitably be linked with Donald Trump.
So the important thing here is that Dino Rossi hasn't really said anything separating himself yet from Donald Trump, and that will be one of the big issues in the race, no doubt. Dino Rossi.
Will he call himself a never Trumper?
He'll be hounded for that. I mean, that's what happens.
He a never Trumper? He must have been on the record at some point.
No, I think he said something along these lines that Donald Trump was maybe his 17th choice or something for president. Mm-hmm. But that he supports the nominee of the party, so far is what he said, words to that effect. Dino Rossi is formidable. He's run statewide 3 times now. He's not a fresh face in this race, that's for sure. So if he's going to be in the race, what he does need is a fresh message, something different than he said all the other times that he ran. And one thing I remember, because I followed him around a lot during some of those other races, he was often talking about, and remember, this was during a sour economy, so things were different and everything was about jobs. And he said often that, I didn't really want to be the candidate, but I'm forced into it because so many people don't have jobs. Obviously, that wouldn't be a message that would work today. But he's going to have to not be the glib guy, like, you're forcing me to do this, beg me to be your guy. He's going to have to kind of change the way that goes. And again, like Dave here, and I hosted that debate between you and Dave Reichert.
That's pretty good.
Over there in Bellevue. That was fun. But
there were no punches thrown, we'd like to point out.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we were separated.
Yeah, but Dave Reichert, he was scared. He said, you're the radio guy. You know what you're doing over
scared.
There. A little bit. Something about the lectern. Anyway, not important. But I looked over the list of Democrats. These are not household names either. But again, they're going to have a little bit of the advantage that about Trump, you know. And this district is very much a swing district. After Dave Reichert said he was not going to run, the Cook Political Report, the Bible on this kind of stuff, listed it as a toss-up district.
Anybody else here run for governor? Wait a second. Rob McKenna.
Wait.
Bueller.
Bueller.
Well, you know, here's why I think Dino will be a very strong candidate in this race. First of all, I don't think he's going to have primary competition or significant primary competition. I know a couple of legislators who I have a lot of respect for were looking at it, but I think you know, Dino is still very popular among Republicans in that district and has a lot of experience. And here's the other thing. He's been a very effective state legislator. Going back to when he negotiated a budget deal with Gary Locke that was so well received that it received glowing reviews in the Seattle Times, for example, and really propelled him to the nomination for governor in 2004. And then more recently in the 2017 legislative session where Dino is serving to fill out Andy Hill's term, he helped put together a budget that passed with bipartisan support. He is a very skilled legislator, which will allow him to campaign on the following message. Congress is dysfunctional. They're not getting things done. I know how to get things done in a legislative body. Send someone back there who can be effective. And I think that is a message that will resonate with voters who are frustrated with gridlock in Washington, D.C.
Did you hear the latest thing Republicans didn't get done? John McCain?
Yes. I heard about that. Came out way in here. Yes.
And says no. He's opposing the latest Republican repeal.
This is still going to hold the vote, right?
I know all the names, right? So they needed to hold on to Lisa Murkowski and John McCain,
and they were going to allow Lisa Murkowski to stay on what amounted to the ACA in exchange for her vote.
So does all that you think? Wild. Are you saying it? Who does that help if every time Congress seems like, well, there's a Republican majority and they don't seem to be able to get anything
here's
done.
Here's what's going
to
happen. Dino's going to be out there campaigning against one of the Democrats who's announced, and maybe more will come in. Maybe one of the Democratic state legislators who lives in that district will decide to run
Is an Issaquah City Council member that's in the group, right?
Tola Martz.
That's right. Yeah. But Dino's going to sound and very knowledgeable because he is, and they're not going to sound that knowledgeable, and they're going to use a lot of sound bites that will sound like sound bites. And I think they're going to find he is not that easy to run against. It is a district which is the most the least Republican of all the districts held by Republicans. But he is a skilled
to the point that Hillary won by 3 points, sure. And Obama won by 2, and then Obama earlier won. I mean, it was shaped differently.
Absolutely, and Dave got reelected by a wide margin. I mean, people routinely split their votes in this state and in any state.
All right, one word predictions then: Republican or Democrat takes this congressional seat.
I think because of the redistricting that occurred with the eastern Washington counties in it, I think Dino will, assuming he is the nominee, and I think he will be, I think he'll win this.
That one word was Republican.
Well, I think it's Republican if the election were held today, but there are so many volatile things going on in Washington, D.C. If this becomes more about controlling the president, then I think it could easily switch.
Mm. Oh, I have to say toss-up.
Okay.
Hyphenated.
Okay.
Democratic opponents, we said Tola Martz, Jason Ritterizer, Mona Das, Kim Schreier, Toby Whitney, and so far on the Republican side, Dino Rossi. This is the Week in Review, and one more political note, by the way, Seattle has a new mayor. After Ed Murray resigned last week, Council President Bruce Harrell held office for 5 days, didn't want to give up his council seat, so Councilmember Tim Burgess was sworn in just until late November, at which time whoever wins between Carrie Moon and Jenny Durkin will take over unusually quickly November 28th. Joni, what should Seattle expect from a 9-week mayor, 10-week mayor?
So Tim Burgess is as solid as they come. You know, he stepped in there and you had this sense pretty quickly, steady hand on the tiller, things won't go awry. He said all the right things. He said, you know, the citizens of Seattle need to know that government is open and functioning and, you know, that we're standing here unified because people have gone through a little trauma here and are trying to figure out, is the city going to be okay? Do we have to wait for this election to really have a leader? Burgess knows everything about the budget. He's a sharp guy there. He's not.
Is he going to do anything? in his short time?
Well, he probably does have to deal with Key Arena v. Soto like that. Add some what?
Add some bike lanes.
Okay. He'll add some bike lanes, and he'll figure out if the Sonics are coming or going or any such thing like that. Uh-huh. And he'll write a decent budget, and he'll get along with most people except for Shama Sawant, who voted against him.
Right.
Shock that that was.
Mm. I mean, something like this is a classic opportunity to, just to do everything right, because you're not beholden to anybody.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he's completely free. He could show what it's like to have a mayor who fixes potholes, makes sure you can add a mother-in-law apartment if you want to, maybe.
Or have your mother-in-law fix the potholes, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Are you saying he could do something controversial because he's not beholden to anyone?
He could do something that,
or that
makes,
he could do...
makes people love him so much that they're thinking, maybe in 4 years we might... He might be an alternative, depending on what happens.
Well, he'll still the council to deal with, of course. The checks and balances will still exist. I ran into him yesterday at an event, and I said, "Councilman, how are you doing?" And he smiled at me and said, "Actually, it's mayor now." And then he grinned in a kind of self-effacing way that's classic Tim Burgess. I think it's impossible not to like the guy, and I think he's an excellent choice for, you know, smoothing the way for the next mayor. I kind of wish he was going to be there till January, actually, because I'd rather have the incoming mayor have more time to get ready. So it's unfortunate
we'll
the way
that
the charter's
written. School down there in the last weeks of November, you know?
Did you hear who Mayor Burgess's new deputy communications person is?
Yeah.
Eli Sanders, Pulitzer Prize winner, associate editor at The Stranger, friend of the show here on KUOW. Absolutely. He's working for Burgess for 10 weeks, paid, and then goes back to the paper to write a story about his time at City Hall. What do you think of that?
He's been wrestling with his conscience more than you have.
Well, in this way, let's be specific. Yeah. So Eli's awesome. You know, we love him on this show. Been here with him. He's an amazing journalist. Very good. He's put himself, he should have made maybe a little bit of a cleaner break with The Stranger during the 71 days, I think, because, I mean, I know he'll do a great job, absolutely, but other journalists from other papers are grumbling a little bit that, you know, if they call up with the big scoop, would they trust his distance from The Stranger not to sort of burn that? And I can understand that, too. I mean, I'm sure Eli will be very careful and not do that, but I understand as well the concern of journalists calling. You're essentially calling, like, guy from Stranger to ask him about some story you've got. So they have to be very careful about that, I think. Down there.
Will people be candid with a reporter who's about to write a story about them?
Well, that's an excellent concern to raise. They will have to make very clear what's on the record and what's off the record and hope that he'll honor it. And they might have to say, and also, you can't write about this
in your piece.
Right. But it'll be very interesting to see what the effect is on him, because he essentially will now, he doesn't have his own voice anymore. He is the voice of the person he's working for. The mayor is his boss, and he has to share the mayor's message, whether he agrees with it or not. And
hello, Sean Spicer.
Well, and I just remember...
No offense, Tim Burgess.
My own transition from being a reporter or a talk show host who was really trying to do both sides to having give a raw meat political speech. And, you know, there's sort of a transition moment there where you say, am I really going to do this? And the moment they start clapping, it becomes fun. And you learn to do it. And the question is, then, can you go back? So I will be very interested to read Eli's memoir of his. Well, I think it'll be called 71 Days.
71 Days, paid by the taxpayers.
What happened?
It could end up
he's
being
paid
a lot.
By the taxpayers during this time. So he has to err on the side of the city and not benefiting ye olde stranger, right?
It could be a lot duller than he thinks it's going to be, of course, if you know, the mayor goes in as just a caretaker and can't get much done. But I think on balance, it'll be good for Eli as a journalist to have an inside view and probably come out with a greater appreciation that governing is a lot harder than it may look. And so it may season him more. And he's a guy who's already really smart and experienced.
We've been talking about politics all hour so far. Politics has been on the sideline pre-game when it comes to the NFL, but it moves to the field. We'll hit that and a couple other things in a moment on the Week in Review. This is KUOW's Week in Review. We're talking with you about what happened this week and why it matters with Joni Balter and Rob McKenna and Dave Ross from Seattle's Morning News on Cairo Radio. Let's keep talking about, as we were, oppression and protest in America. You know about NFL players kneeling during the national anthem. Seahawks lineman Michael Bennett's been sitting for the anthem. Now his politics are coming to the field of play, because when Bennett sacks the quarterback, sometimes he has raised his fist. And this week he tweeted that the raised fist represents unity or solidarity with oppressed peoples. So it sounds like we can expect to see that on the field. Does this seem like an important change, on-field solidarity with oppressed people?
So you know, this is sort of inevitable if you think about it, because it started, you know, at the beginning of the game, and now it's moving to the actual field. The NFL is going to have to decide. They decide these things all the time. They're going to have to decide how much of this they want in the middle of the game. And we've seen an example of this with the celebrating in the end zone stuff that went on for a while. You couldn't do any of the dancing, any of the stuff. Still no twerking. I hope you know that.
But how could they outlaw a raised fist?
Well, I don't know, but they were able to have rules about celebrating. And then in May this year, they came out and said, well, let's bring the fun back to football. I guess the ratings weren't so hot. So let's bring the fun back. And they sort of authorized certain kinds of fun celebrating. Again, no twerking, but you can, you know, use the football. You can do a little dancing. You can't make fun of the other team somehow. And I don't, you know, I haven't really watched
only
enough.
Two pelvic thrusts.
Yeah,
that's,
right.
That's
exactly
a real
right.
thing.
No, that's exactly
that was an
right.
actual NFL
He's exactly
rule.
Exactly right about that.
In
it's
fact,
two, not three.
Exactly. Michael Bennett used to do his sack dance in the past was a hip thrust, and his joke about it was, two pumps gets you a baby, three pumps gets you a fine. That's Michael Bennett.
Okay.
And now, because it's relevant, because the NFL, as you say, does get into, you can do this, you cannot do this, but how could they and would they want to try to crack down on a raised fist or other things the referee is supposed to deem as political?
I'm still trying to deal with how that particular symbol works. So if you sack the quarterback, you raise your fist in solidarity, but then shouldn't the guy you just sacked also raise his fist in solidarity? Because that would be real solidarity. I mean, are you going...
He's on the ground and isn't thinking solidarity at that moment.
I understand how at the Olympics in Mexico, you know, where they stood on the podium and they raised their fists. Okay, I guess that makes sense. But in the context of sacking the quarterback, how does it make sense? That's the part I don't get.
Well, it would be more noticeable on the road, right? If the Seahawks are home and Michael Bennett just sacked the quarterback, mm-hmm. the crowd reaction is going to be exactly the same.
So you're in solidarity with the fans.
Yeah, well, they'll scream with approval no matter what, right? But if you're in Green Bay and you're doing something that you've tweeted about as a political gesture and you just sacked their quarterback, they're booing you in a way beyond what they would do if they just lost 6 yards.
And so
that gets attention.
So the boo will be connected to the fist in the air, and that'll be seen as the wrong response or something? How do we manage that?
Well, maybe, that's why I don't get it.
Maybe the NFL should try not overreacting and, like, let's just let things go and not become overly obsessed. I mean, I know they're concerned about the declining ratings, and there's that Forbes article that says that, you know, 32% of viewers say they're less likely to watch a game because of these players who are protesting during the national anthem. Who knows why ratings are down, whether that's actually a factor
that
or not.
That poll, though. I mean,
is highly suspect,
you know,
because maybe the ratings are down because they have a game on almost every single night.
And yeah, saturation.
People are like,
maybe?
There it is again. Oh, my gosh.
And by the way, ratings down from stratospheric levels.
Right.
That's exactly
but that's
right.
why they added all the nights. So maybe they added too many nights, like check your programming. Or maybe it's about concussions and people don't want to support us.
Yeah, I don't like the idea of putting it on these players who are engaging in a kind of protest. I mean, there is a difference between doing something on the field than on the sidelines during the national anthem, because, you know, Bennett sits quietly on the bench.
Yep.
You know, and the cameras aren't necessarily on him if they ever are. But and when you're on the field, the cameras are on. But let's just let this go and not overreact. And, you know, I do want to comment on one thing, though, Joni. You're absolutely right about the problem they've created for themselves at the NFL by saying, okay, ratings are down. Let's let them celebrate more, make it more entertaining. Once you do that, then you're opening the door to other kinds of expression. So be it.
Exactly.
Do you think we'll learn anything about Seahawks fans about whether they love anything their hometown heroes do, or whether they quote unquote don't want politics in my football or something in
between. Depends on whether they're winning.
I think that's the whole business, because Seahawks fans, let's admit it, we expect things to happen.
Right.
We expect certain
winning
to happen.
Seahawks players can afford a house even in Seattle. Can we talk about a way to help people afford a house if they can't, thanks to this new startup company that offers to pay part of your down payment if you'll agree to turn one of your rooms into an Airbnb unit and give this company most of that income? Reporter Monica Nicholsberg at GeekWire wrote about this company called Loftium.
They will help you out with your down payment. They can do about $20,000 per bedroom that you're willing to rent out on Airbnb after you buy your house. So that's in Seattle where they're first launching. So if I want to buy a house and I don't have the money up front, they'll give it to me and I sign a contract with them that agrees to rent out either a bedroom or a mother-in-law for a period between about 12 to 36 months and then share the profits with them. Like, they might take back 70% and I get to keep 30% of the money I make from that Airbnb.
And it's not a loan that you have to pay back. If nobody wants to rent your place, that's Loftium's problem.
Yeah. Risky business. I mean, I interviewed the founders and I interviewed their first customer. And it's a genius premise, but it depends on how desperate you are for that upfront down payment. Because in exchange, you got to rent your home for a room in your home for up to 3 years. I think what makes Airbnb appealing to homeowners is that you can control whether you want to rent it that night or not, whether you want to share the room with somebody or not. Here, you've basically signed a contract that says you have to have that available and you have to agree to do it for up to 3 years. And if you don't, if you break that contract, they can put a lien on your house. So there is a catch to it.
I think it's also a genius idea, and I think it's, you know, fitting for the times for so many people who have college loans and don't have another way to get into a house. But I think it has time problems. So let's say it's a couple, and let's say they sign all this and agree all this, and a year later they have twins or triplets, and they're going to need those rooms. So I think, you know, I don't think we know enough about how it will really work or who it would really benefit over time. Because many things, mom is coming to live with you, who knows, could change the availability of that rental part of the house.
Well, mom gets the garden shed in that case.
Yes.
This could actually make homes with mother-in-law apartments separately accessible units more valuable you're more comfortable in this arrangement if you know that they're not going to walk through your living room.
Right.
The guests are actually separate.
Although you could do that without them, though. I mean, you could just, if you start designing more houses with that option, then people could just say, count this as part of my income.
Right.
And that might make it more likely for you to get a larger loan.
Yeah. Does it feel like it's putting strapped people in a reality show? You know, like,
all right, they have to put cameras on all the time, too.
Right.
Yeah, they have to see if they get along, and then they vote different people out of the house.
Of the house. I think
it feels squirmy that way. Yeah. Lots of people, they're deciding, boy, I'm going to try being an Airbnb host, and who knows how it's going to go. But the extra ingredient of that do you want a down payment or do you not? How's this going to, do they know what they're in for? Seems itchy.
As a parent of four kids, two of whom are millennials who have, you know, been in the housing market or they have friends who are out looking at houses, they're all talking about the prospects for a particular house in terms of rental. They're all thinking, they're factoring that in. It is a factor they take into account because they realize they can generate revenue that'll help pay the mortgage. And this is just the next step, it seems to me, because, of course, the biggest barrier, as this article points out and we've discussed, is coming up with a down payment. If it helps them get the down payment and they're already thinking about renting out their house, they better walk in, you know, open-eyed, as you point out, Dave, because this is a contractual commitment. But more power to them if they get to a house sooner and can afford to buy it because of this help.
I will tell you, and you must know this too because you got kids, the single most common topic of phone calls between my kids and me has been roommate problems.
Well, there's that.
What do they say?
Just because of different habits. Sometimes it comes down to how picky the roommate is about recycling certain classes of plastic. You know,
they do dishes or do they leave dishes or
right? And
I thought you were talking about Mrs. Ross for a minute.
No, I'm talking about your kids. I'm talking about the kids. No, this is the topic when I get a call and said, "Dad, I got to talk to you about this." About 50% of the time, it's, this is what my roommate did this time.
Dad, are you sitting down? Because this is serious, okay? She puts the tines of the fork the wrong way in the dishwasher. It's that level of threat, that kind of thing.
And what are you going to do about it, Dad?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And this is, the city's considering taxing Airbnb hosts right now because they take homes off the market for short-term rentals. Reduces the number of long-term rentals, that makes them more expensive. So this idea lands in the middle of a, we're already having a political fight about Airbnbs.
In full disclosure, my firm represents one of the, you know, a company that's in the short-term rental business. So we've been looking at statutes all over the country, and we're, what we typically see is more pushback in terms of zoning regulations and restrictions, taxation, et cetera, where you're talking about the entire apartment being rented out endlessly, or an entire house. The restrictions are usually less when the owner remains in the home when the renter is there. So the policymakers are drawing that distinction, and it seems to me like it's a reasonable distinction to draw.
Right, because it's not an empty house. It's not a house that's just driving up the market in the way that it's doing.
And you're not turning an apartment building into basically a de facto hotel.
Well, I think most baby boomers agree whatever helps the millennials get out of the house is probably a good business.
Good point.
He said pointedly.
I asked that reporter, could I take Loftium's money and then make my Airbnb so unattractive that no stranger wants to live with me? She said, technically, yes, but you do agree to keep your place up, et cetera. Okay, so Dave Ross, I haven't asked. Can we put you on the record? You are running for Congress against...
No, you may not put me on the record.
Oh, I may not?
No.
Okay.
Why would I do that?
You've done it once.
And as I said,
research shows
that
people who have run for Congress are more likely to run again
than
people who haven't. I believe so.
Yeah, well, it's right.
He's not even in the. You're not in the district anymore. They moved.
You don't have to be in the district.
I know, but they blame you for it if you.
Yeah.
Rob McKenna running for Congress, 8th district.
And I have been reminded more than once. Oh, you don't have to live in the district to run. But no, God bless those folks who do it. I don't care what party they belong to. And I see them when I go back to D.C. on business, and I think every time I see our delegation on the plane, thank goodness I don't do this every week.
Rob McKenna, former state attorney general. Dave Ross, Seattle's Morning News on Cairo Radio. Joni Balter, Seattle Channel Civic Cocktail. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
We'll do it again next week.